for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me. I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that is probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the poet Lauren Camp. Prior to becoming a poet, Lauren Camp was a visual artist. Her art has appeared everywhere from the American Jazz Museum and the Delta Blues Museum to the Fiber Art Biennial in Chieri, Italy, and is part of the permanent collections of many public institutions, from St. Vincent's Children's Hospital of Indiana to the U.S. embassies in Ashgabat, Turkmenistan, and Bamako, Mali. For 15 years, Lauren Camp was also a producer for Santa Fe Public Radio and host of the show Audio Saucepan, described as a delicious one-hour journey through poems, philosophical fragments, and literary excerpts intermixed with jazz, spirituals, world percussion, and other sounds. A show with multiple moods, a saucy potluck of reason and tempo. Lauren Camp is also the author of 4 previous collections of poetry. These include 100 Hungers, winner of the Dorset Prize and a finalist for the Arab American Book Award, and Turquoise Door, Finding Mabel Dodge Lujan in New Mexico, a finalist for the New Mexico Arizona Book Award. Her poems have appeared in the Los Angeles Review, Pleiades, Beloit Poetry Journal, and Witness, among many others. They've been translated into Turkish, Mandarin, Arabic, and Spanish, and Camp has twice served as a guest editor for World Literature Today for the issues dedicated to jazz poetry and the intersection of visual art and poetry, and also a guest editor at Malpais Review for their issue dedicated to the poetry of Iraq. Camp lives in New Mexico and teaches through the state's Poetry Out Loud program, the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum's Art and Leadership program at Santa Fe Community College, and through her own community workshops. Lauren Camp is here today on Between the Covers to talk about her newest collection just out from Tupelo Press called Took House. Publishers Weekly calls Took House a stirring, original collection that delves into hunger and longing, asking the reader to linger in the fraught space between control and the loss of it. D.M. O'Connor for Rhino Poetry calls Took House minimal yet soaring, cemented in time and form yet fluid. There are love poems, avant-garde experiments, prose chunks, free verse, and brick-solid couplets. Hawks, owls, coyotes, and ravens mix with Georgia O'Keeffe, Donald Judd, and Annie Leibovitz. Doubtlessly, Camp is an artisan working with culmination. Each poem stands sound and true. Finally, poet Allison Bennis White says, in Lauren Camp's Took House, we are enveloped in a poetry both precise and mysterious, intimate and sublime. Reading through these poems, I was reminded of the tenet that poetry is not like the interior life, but is the interior life, the thing itself made flesh via language. Give me your flowered ear, Camp writes in one poem, and in another, I will speak of the seams of desire, the practice, and even the ceiling. Here is a poet articulating her human existence, the tentacles of love, inebriation, visual art. Here is a particular heart and mind removing its shield in order to commune, to help us see the world again, more deeply and more strangely. And reader, I am grateful. Welcome to Between the Covers, Lauren Camp.
Delighted to be here, David. Thank you so much.
So before we talk about Took House in particular, I thought we could start with a discussion of ekphrastic poetry more generally, poetry that's engaged with visual art, not only because there are a lot of poems in Took House that are ekphrastic, poems that engage with Georgia O'Keeffe or Robert Rauschenberg or Donald Judd or Eva Hess and many others, but also because from what I've read, you came to poetry somewhat accidentally when you were a visual artist, and that the first texts you were writing were almost accidental ekphrastic texts. So I was hoping maybe we could start with your origin story as a poet, how that came from the visual art world, but also how you continue to engage with the visual art world.
I was making visual art. My medium was fabric and thread. And a lot of my subject matter, but not all of it, was jazz. All of these things are actually important because they all impact how I learned to become a poet. So I was creating visual art, wall hangings, and writing at some point in the process, some years in, I began writing wall text for the artwork as the pieces would be exhibited, be asked, invited to be on walls in art centers and museums and shows. The curators of the shows would ask for wall text, which they called blurbs. That is what it's called in that world. And and I wrote those blurbs with the intention of, I guess, describing the artwork. For some artists in that medium, they would write about the materials they used, perhaps how many stitches or how many spools of thread or how long it took. That never interested me, so I began to write just these things that I just called blurbs for lack of any other term. And at some point, I wouldn't even be able to give you a year, but maybe it was like the early 2000s. Somebody saw a solo exhibit that I had in Kentucky and called me over and said, "I know you made the artwork. Who wrote the poems?"
It's probably the first time a blurb has been, I mean, the first time blurb and poem have been put together.
I said, I was so confused. I mean, really, I was very, very lost in that question. I said, "There are no poems here." And that viewer, art appreciator, took me over to the piece that she pointed out to me was a portrait I had done of Billie Holiday in fabric and thread. And she said, "Here, this piece, who wrote this poem?" And she pointed to my blurb. And I said, "Oh, that's a blurb. I wrote it." And after that, I mean, this is truly it's like nearly an embarrassing story of how to come to poetry from the backside of it, really knowing nothing in some ways. After that, I came back to New Mexico, heard one of my friends talk about a poetry group she was in, and I sort of sidled over and said, "Could I be in that? What is that? Could I be in that?" And she said, "Well, this group is closed, but I know of another." And so I had to sort of come to poetry from the center of it, in a way.
Well, I suspect a lot of people who either haven't tried ekphrastic poetry or haven't thought a lot about ekphrastic poetry might think it is simply an attempt to describe the visual art as best as one could. But often it isn't that at all and can be quite oblique to or even decoupled from the act of description. I'm thinking of Jory Graham's description of ekphrasis for her, and where she said, "A painting is, in a poem, a painting run through an imagination and a spirit other than the painter's. It is not trying to describe the painting, it is trying to speak from it." Of course, this isn't a definitive definition of ekphrastic poetry, but rather the definition for Graham. But I wondered how that struck you, and if you had a certain philosophy or orientation when you're engaging with visual art poetically.
Yeah, I think I agree with that quote in great part. And I might even go further and say that for me, sometimes it doesn't even have to be to speak from it, but to speak underneath it or above it, or to give a different side to it. I have no interest in writing precisely what I see. I want to take that artwork and have it help me figure out something more. Maybe something about me, maybe something about a particular time. But often what I'm doing with the art that I'm drawn to is trying to figure out why. Why this piece? Why this work? Why this style? Why these colors? Why this emptiness? Why this whatever? Why this, for a lot of the works in Took House, why this repetition?
The first section of the book is called The Exact Color of Welcome. And the first poem within the first section is called Find the Color of Survival. And the notion of welcome or survival having a color points to the gap between language and perception, at least for me. It seems like in any act of representation, there is that gap. How to perceive something and then translate it into a word or a painting or a dance. But with ekphrastic poems, it feels like the gap is more foregrounded because one is making a representation from another representation, a poem from a painting that itself was trying to represent something. Is that gap what you're reaching for with these titles, The Exact Color of Welcome and Find the Color of Survival? And if not, then tell us about the impulse to insert the notion of color here.
I think as a visual artist, or a one-time visual artist at any rate, I think in color and texture. What for me is very familiar and common, but what seems to be not for others. Survival seems like I could say it has a color, even though I can't tell you right now what that color is. It just has a color. It's not so much a feeling as a tangible thing, which I think color is.
Could we hear Find the Color of Survival?
Sure. Find the Color of Survival. I want to talk about what I believe is beautiful, and this is complicated by all the oil of that year. The muscle of my mind was worn out. I was painting everything at once, painting until the impulse died and began again. I tended to let days scatter to bruises on canvas. Absolute color, the temperature I tolerated, and my hands the only source of compassion. My eyes stayed on the symbols of other artists' corners and saw as they spread to a world that existed through another parking lot, a skein of grasses. Four shades of green could have and bend the eye. Even in excess, I always see the most trivial details. Even then, I was always sure a return to heaven's brightness. These are the matters for which there are no limits. How far imagination commands, and I splendored over it. I starved to praise, contented in the ways of light and bed and silhouette, because I had sacrificed to muddy palms and art inscribed with truth and the dominion of hues. The breathless blue. I believe you'll see in every image pleasure and 20 different senses. Every past in the right and wrong place, so many times no one can tell if they saw us. A woman tying a black apron brought the cutlery to our table. At home, I lifted a broad brush to each sorrow. One day soon, every form will be transparent. But first, with you, I'm looking at even what I cannot stand to see.
You've been listening to Lauren Camp read from her latest collection, Took House. So I restrained myself to one question of epic length, so forgive this one. But one of my favorite essays about the gap in representation is an essay by Ann Carson called Variations on the Right to Remain Silent. And part of what she discusses in it is the philosophy of the painter Francis Bacon. And your use of color made me think of that essay, but so did your epigraph by the artist Eva Hess, which mentions edges. Your epigraph says, "My right or wrong isn't to have a pure or fine edge." And when I read that, I thought of Ann Carson on Francis Bacon, where she says, "He is a representational painter. His subjects are people, birds, dogs, grass, sand, water, himself. And what he wants to capture of these subjects is, he says, their reality or essence or the facts. By facts, he doesn't mean to make a copy of the subject as a photograph would, but rather to create a sensible form that will translate directly to your nervous system the same sensation as the subject." And then later she says, "Stops and silence of various kinds seem to be available to Francis Bacon with the process of his painting. For instance, in his subject matter, when he chooses to depict people screaming in a medium that cannot transmit sound, or in his use of color, which is a complex matter, but let's look at one aspect of it, namely the edges of the color. His aim as a painter, as we have seen, is to grant sensation without the boredom of its conveyance. He wants to defeat narrative wherever it seems to arise, which is pretty much everywhere, since humans are creatures who crave a story. There is a tendency for story to slip into the space between any two figures or any two marks on a canvas. Bacon uses color to silence this tendency. He pulls color right up to the edge of his figures, a color so hard, flat, bright, motionless, it is impossible to enter into or to wonder about. There's a desolation of curiosity in it. He once said he'd like to put a Sahara desert or the distances of a Sahara in between parts of a painting. His color has an excluding and accelerating effect. It makes your eye move on. It's a way of saying, don't linger here and start thinking up stories, just stick to the facts. Sometimes he puts a white arrow on top of the color to speed your eye and denounce storytelling even more. To look at this arrow is to feel an extinguishing of narrative. He says he got the idea for the arrows from a golf manual." And I know this is probably a stretch, but I was thinking of his employment of color to stop narrative in the lines you just read. "The muscle of my mind was worn out. I was painting everything at once, painting until the impulse died and began again. I tended to let days scatter to bruises on a canvas." And I guess it made me wonder about your epigraph, what it meant to you and why you chose this specific quote by Eva Hess as the way to introduce us to Tookhouse.
Well, let me first say that the passage you read from Ann Carson is magnificent and feels completely logical to me, I think. It makes me want to go and read the whole thing. But that idea of granting sensation through sort of translating a sensation seems exactly right. A person can't take something in one medium and shift it to another medium without doing some translating work, some work. You know, you can't make the same music without an instrument that you would with an instrument. So if my medium is words to describe music, I have to do some work to find those words. Or, you know, take your pick what the analogy is. If I'm trying to describe artwork and I'm using words, that's a lot different from using resin like Eva Hesse did. The quote, the epigraph to start the book is, oh, it pleases me so much, this epigraph. The fact that it isn't black and white, that it isn't, perhaps even built into her quote is that there isn't a right or wrong, that it doesn't, that the edges blur, that the box doesn't contain it, the vessel doesn't contain exactly the answer anyone wants.
The cover sort of evokes that too, the house that seems to want to be more than a house.
The cover artwork is, I would love to shout out to the cover artist. It's a woman in Albuquerque whose work I've known for a long time. Her name is Suzanne Sparge. And when I found this piece, which is called Nest, I was basically exhilarated because it seemed to have everything I needed. It was almost as though Suzanne had read the book, distilled the poems, and created this artwork. Though that isn't how it happened, but it really felt like it went right along with the poems so exactly, and in a way that is also very open and capacious.
Well, you have a poem that engages with the person who wrote the epigraph, Eva Hesse, entitled "Instead Small, Rather Huddled," and so on. And it engages with a work of hers called Repetition 19-3, which felt in conversation to me with your Donald Judd poem called Empirical Theories of a Box Maker, which engages with Judd's 100 untitled works. They feel in conversation because Judd's work and Hesse's work are both engaged with repetition, with Judd's boxes being more uniform and Hesse's weird latex plastic shapes having more variations, but all coming from a certain core form. And we could also say perhaps that they're both in conversation with your poem about O'Keeffe's Black Earth series, where she returns over and over again to the same view to paint the same place many different times. On top of that, you also have a poem called Repetitions that isn't explicitly about a specific work of art. But it made me all wonder about your attraction to art that enacts repetition, and then also what role repetition plays in your work, if you feel like repetition is a motif or a tool that you employ.
I think repetition is a tool I employ in revision more than anywhere else, and especially in these poems. I began the poems that now make up Took House in 2005, and for a long time it was a sort of vast collection of poems that then shifted and enlarged and shrunk, and within those poems they were revised, they were shortened, lengthened, stretched out. I did a huge amount to the poems themselves and to the collection. So in that way, there was a lot of repetition. There's also, for me, repetition in the core story within this collection, the going back, the drinking, the appetites, the tables, even the repetition of hungers.
And so what about your attraction to repetition within the work of the artist you chose? Like you say, one of the things that you're confronted with when you're doing ekphrastic poetry is, why am I engaging with this specific art? It seems to me like you're drawn to artists who are drawn to the repetition of form.
It might seem like that, but I think what you're seeing is a selection of ekphrastic works that I made more intuitively, but I've written a lot of ekphrastic poems, not all of which deal with repetition. So partly I made that choice of what to include in the book, and I was drawn to the ekphrastic poems that had that repetition, or had the minimalism, or had the open-ended quality to them. But there are a lot of other poems I've written, ekphrastic poems, that are really not at all, I'm scanning in my head some of the artworks that are not at all repetitive, or not much repetitive. But I also want to say that I have a kind of extreme fascination for the artworks that almost feel like they're meditating or meditative, maybe, that are empty or open or quiet. And I would love to think that's because that's how I am, but it's probably more a factor of that's what I need more. I don't know.
Well, I was hoping, I picked out two poems that to me felt like repetition leaped out. Let the Other, and I Recommend You Not Empty of Content.
Okay. Let the Other. Let the other woman be identical. Let her be exhausted in pretty and soiling. Let her not be too lonely. Let her protect what she knows, and let one take blood from the other. Let one see each later version. Let her never keep her eyes open. Let them both have a chance to be tender in the beautiful rooms. Let them be strangers with distance. Let each rearrange the heart. Let there be viscera and once and fact and fierce pattern. Let the hints happen little by little. Let the one scream. Let there be sleeves of rain. Let her open a map and decide to move forward. Let each form from the heavy edges in the black part of night. The second poem, I Recommend You Not Empty of Content, is a pantoum, actually. I Recommend You Not Empty of Content. When I stood and tore rocks from the edge of our porch, you saw I was otherwise empty of details, of spark. From words to cup, to hope, to wake, you called for help. From the edge of our porch, you saw I was otherwise caught in the arch of defeat. No chances to hope, to wake. You called for help that day. October was visible in every direction. Caught in the arch of defeat. No chances. How many times could we do this? I almost slid off that day. October was visible in every direction, taut, then shaking. Was this on your heart? How many times could we do this? I almost slid off from the place we called home. Pity the riddle, taut, then shaking. Was this on your heart? Your sturdy going on, your exhaustion with the place we called home? Pity the riddle, empty of details, of spark. From words to cup, you're sturdy going on, your exhaustion when I stood and tore rocks.
We've been listening to Lauren Camp read from her latest collection of poetry, Took House. So you mentioned the second poem is a pantoum, and you've talked about how that is a good form for dealing with something hard or for any sort of obsession or any issue a writer can't stop thinking about. Why is that the case?
Because within the form, it repeats. It allows it's a very strict structure that allows those lines to repeat in specific places. But in the process of doing that, you have to add in new content or new perspective sometimes. And so the form is both directed and, again, open-ended, again, requiring or allowing discovery, because you don't really know what you're going to be able to or have to say when the line returns in a new position. And I will also say that pantoums are, I think they're a marvelous form. I restrain myself in using them, but I love them. I love teaching them. And I have a loose parameter of wishing to have a pantoum in every book.
Has that been happening so far?
I've done pretty well. Not exact, yeah. But I'm pretty good.
Thank you for being on Between the Covers today, Lauren.
It's been a very big pleasure. Thank you.
Talking today to the poet Lauren Camp about her latest book from Tupelo Press, Took House. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio.
Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm SW Conser. Carol Lay has been creating comics, both alternative and mainstream, since the 1980s. She's a writer, illustrator, and animator whose weekly comic, Story Minute, ran in newspapers for 20 years. In 2007, Carol visited Portland for the Stumptown Comics Fest and took time out of her busy schedule to share her formidable storytelling skills with our radio listeners. And now, Carol Lay, interviewed by Bill Dodge at the KBOO Studios in September of 2007.
What are you, the fashion police?
My guest on this installment of Words and Pictures, Carol Lay, has been a professional cartoonist and illustrator for more than 25 years. She has done work for indie and mainstream comics, magazines, and newspapers, as well as animation and storyboards for live-action film projects. Carol's weekly strip, Story Minute, has been running over a